for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm, New Hampshire hosts the nation's first presidential primary, and it's where most of the 2012 Republican contenders gathered last night to debate each other. Joining me to analyze just how they did and where the campaigns go from here, Michael Tomosky of Newsweek and The Daily Beast, Ron Elving of NPR, Stephen Hayes of The Weekly Standard and Fox News, joining us from Manchester, New Hampshire, Susan Page of USA Today. I really want to hear your thoughts about last night's debate. So give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Susan Page, give us a sense of the tone of the evening.
The tone was, I would say, pretty fast-paced. We felt that sometimes we were just careening from issue to issue. It was also largely positive among the Republican candidates, with one or two exceptions. No criticism of each other or even of the front runner, Mitt Romney. Instead, all the fire was directed at President Obama, especially on the issue of the economy. He got bashed every way he could by the candidates who were on stage last night.
And Ron Elving, I'm sure you watched, listened to every word. Mitt Romney went in as the candidate to beat. I mean, were they after him? Were the others after him?
I'd say if he were so inclined, it would be a good night for Mitt Romney to chill some champagne, or maybe just a little bit. Because while the other candidates certainly were after him, it was mostly in the sense of trailing after him. They did not go after him the way some people, many of us, had expected they would. He had the target on his back. He's the front runner, no question about it, in New Hampshire and nationally. And it seemed like their first opportunity to try to bring him down a peg. They didn't do it. Even Tim Pawlenty, who had taken him on pretty seriously on Sunday, saying that the Obama health care plan was just the Romney plan and calling it, in fact, Obamacare. When he was given the opportunity to continue
he
that attack,
he didn't use that word.
Clearly backed off of it two times, three times. A little biblical there. It got just a little bit dramatic for just a moment, because it was so clear that Tim Pawlenty did not want to take this opportunity to take Mitt Romney on.
Michael Tomosky, was there some agreement among those candidates to really sort of back off each other and stay focused on Obama?
Well, I doubt, Diane, that there was any kind of explicit agreement. I think it was just a natural course of things in a first major debate. There was, of course, one previous debate in South Carolina, but the major contenders, particularly Romney, were not there. So I don't think there was anything explicit. I think it was just natural that they wanted to get out there, talk to the base. The base wants to hear Obama bashing, and that's what they wanted to do. The current circumstances of our political situation, particularly the recent jobs numbers and the unemployment number, made that a more attractive thing for them to do. I think over time, obviously, we'll hear them try to separate themselves from one another. But I also think that there probably aren't very many big differences among them on major questions.
Steve Hayes, I kept asking before the debates began, wasn't this a debate for declared candidates? And until last night, Michelle Bachmann had not declared. She chose last night to do that.
Yeah, it was sort of talking about drama, the one moment of real drama when she didn't answer directly the first question, or at least took a moment before she did and announced that she would be filing her papers, and there was some applause in the audience. You know, I thought the most interesting moment of the night was this Tim Pawlenty-Mitt Romney exchange. And one of the reasons I thought it was so interesting is I had spent some time with Tim Pawlenty in Iowa really a week and a half ago. And asked him in the course of our conversation, we talked about policy for maybe a half hour and then talked about politics and process for 15 minutes. And I asked him, do you trust Mitt Romney? And it was a clear setup. If you wanted to take an opportunity to challenge Romney, either really go on the attack or just point out substantive differences, he could have done so. And he didn't take that opportunity. And so I pressed him. And he didn't take the opportunity again. And this went on five or six times, almost mirroring what we saw last night. So what's odd is his decision on Sunday to talk about Obamacare and to launch this attack and then pull back from it last night. Doesn't make a lot of sense.
What do you make of it, Susan?
I thought it was odd and quite damaging to Temperley. You know, it's not as if Temperley is the front runner. He's in single digits. He's been he's at 6% in the USA Today Gallup poll that came out on Monday, fifth in the field. That's not a strong position. He wants to make an impression. He wants to be seen as the alternative to Romney. He didn't do that last night. And I'll tell you what else was perplexing. When he coined that word Obamacare in one of the Sunday shows, I think he was on Fox News Sunday, his campaign then immediately sent out emails highlighting it in case anybody had missed it. And so then you thought that was going to be a line of attack. And it's a clever one because it's got a little bit of humor. So you're having a zinger, but you don't look too mean. And for him to refuse to repeat the word, even after John King, the moderator from CNN, went after him a couple times, I thought it was perplexing, and I thought it raised questions about his capabilities as a candidate in this league.
Interesting. Michael?
I thought there was a second odd Temperley moment, which came toward the end, which had to do with foreign policy, when he was asked about the bombing campaign in Yemen. And he invoked September 11th, and he got kind of thunderous and passionate for probably the first time, or the most passionate he got, I think, during the entire 2 hours was while he was answering that question. And on the surface, maybe it sounded good, but then you step back and you thought, well, all he's really doing here is endorsing what the Obama administration is doing in Yemen. And yet he got all high and mighty. It was a little bit of a strange moment.
Ron Elving, tell me about the rules for last night's debate. Were there any?
The rules essentially were John King, but John King, I thought, did a good job. I thought he was a strong moderator. Susan mentioned the pace, and while I think the pace might have been a little breakneck at times, it's a two-hour show, and you're trying to pull an audience here, and you're trying to keep not only the people in the hall interested, but also millions of people around the country watching on television, and far, far more people watching it on YouTube today and looking just for the good bits. And this is an important thing from the standpoint of the moderator, so that was really much more of a personality thing, and the rules were try to keep your answers under 30 seconds. Now, some of these guys had already pre-recorded little tapes in their head that ran a lot more than 30 seconds, and they were trying to get those longer speeches in, try to fit their stump speech into their answers, and John King was working very hard trying to cut that off.
On that very point, posted on the DR Show website from Andy is the following. I thought the format of the debate did a disservice to the process of assessing candidates. The moderator continually cut them off. Ironically, he would say, we need to keep things short so we can get to more. I believe he had it exactly backwards. If he has a big question, such as, is a 5% annual rate of growth a reasonable expectation, then he should allow adequate time for a response. Certainly more than 30 seconds, Steve Hayes.
Well, or in some cases even more than, you know, than one or two sentences. I mean, I think there was some frustration, I think, both from the viewers and from the candidates themselves that they weren't given an opportunity to really talk about the issues or even to answer the questions as they were posed. I mean, it's a delicate dance. I don't envy John King for having to be in this position because on the one hand, as Ron says, you don't want to let these guys just filibuster. I mean, they can blab on for 10 minutes if you let them, so you don't want them to do that. On the other hand, you really do need to, if you're going to explore their views on these things, you really do need to give them an opportunity to answer the questions. And I think in that context, there wasn't enough time for some of these candidates. And the other, I think, odd thing about the format of the way the debate went was how little foreign policy discussion there was. I mean, that didn't happen until 20 minutes left in this two-hour debate. And even then, it was almost sort of a glancing passing discussion on foreign policy.
This format, I think, definitely favors some candidates over others. Someone like Herman Cain, for example, the Godfather's Pizza executive who's used to giving inspirational speeches or being a talk show host and talking for as long as he likes, or for that matter, Ron Paul, the congressman, who is a person who's a libertarian with a very elaborate kind of philosophy. It's quite different from ordinary republicanism. It takes a little time to explain. His views are quite different, especially on foreign policy. And so he wants a little bit more time to get his points out. When he doesn't get it, when he gets interrupted, he becomes a little bit uncomfortable. He gets knocked off his stride. He doesn't really get a good chance to represent himself.
Susan Page, Chris has posted a question on Facebook, says, if Michelle Bachmann's announcement last night wasn't official, what was it?
It was, you know, I was just going to say through the previous discussion that I don't think people take nearly enough into consideration the needs of newspaper reporters. Because we're sitting there, you know, you start filing stories. My first story had to be filed at 8:45 p.m. to my editor back in Washington. And I think they should do, so I was a little frustrated by the format and the fact that candidates didn't get not only not enough time to answer questions, but that the follow-ups weren't as full as I had hoped they would be. I sort of contrast it with your show, Diane, which is kind of marked by, of course, a very thoughtful discussion, a lot of follow-ups, and of course it's very different. The demands in a debate with seven people is a different thing. But in that way, I thought it was an unsatisfactory debate. But in terms of who used the format best, Michelle Bachmann. First of all, the very question that Chris raises, her first time out, she announces that she's officially filed her papers at the FEC to be a former candidate. The FEC told us this morning that they, in fact, had found that in the mail this morning, so she was telling the truth. That gave you something to say at the top of the story. I thought she was the breakout star.
Interesting. Susan Page, she's Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, joining us from Manchester, New Hampshire. Welcome back. We're talking about last night's first presidential debate in New Hampshire with Michael Tomosky. He's with Newsweek and the Daily Beast, editor of the quarterly journal Democracy. Ron Elving is Washington editor for NPR. Stephen Hayes is with the Weekly Standard and Fox News. Susan Page of USA Today, she's in Manchester, New Hampshire. Here's a tweet from Tashwell. Remember, says Tashwell, no voters in New Hampshire actually watched the game. The Bruins game was on. The media and insiders watched it. Is that probably true, Susan?
That is totally true. Biggest applause line when Mitt Romney announced that the Bruins were leading 4-0.
And here's a tweet from Clayton. Michelle Bachmann exceeded expectations. Her strong performance may have gone a long way toward moving Sarah Palin off stage for 2012, Steve Hayes.
I think that is absolutely true. I mean, she was, as Susan said, the breakout star of the night. You know, I think she benefited from low expectations coming in. People didn't expect her to perform that way. But you go back and you look at, I watched the debate last night and then I listened to it on the way in. And you go back and you look at and listen to the substance of her answers was quite good. Her answer on health care for a Republican audience appealing to conservatives was pitch perfect. She started talking about Obamacare and taking some shots that you would expect a candidate to do about Obamacare. And then she talked about the Congressional Budget Office's estimate that it would cost 800,000 jobs, which is exactly what you want to be saying at this moment. Then she talked about Medicare and talked about the amount of money that is being shifted away from traditional Medicare to Obamacare more broadly, which is a discussion of entitlement reform. It's an appeal to seniors. I mean, everything she did in that answer was just as you would do if you were her strategist and you had scripted it out 6 weeks ago. And the more you listen to her answers, the more she did that answer after answer after answer.
So what about Sarah Palin, Michael Tomasky?
I never thought Sarah Palin was inclined to run. I guess if last night has any effect on her thinking, it probably makes her somewhat less inclined. but, you know, I do think that Bachman, and it's not just because they're both women. There have been these comparisons, and some people have complained that it's unfair because they're both women. But that's not the reason. The reason is that they both appeal to a very similar constituency. They both appeal to more of the Tea Party wing of the conservative primary electorate. Having said that, there is a difference between Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachman, which has always been evident to me and which is why Bachman did not really exceed my expectations, which is Bachman, however extreme her views, does know her stuff in policy terms in a way that I think Sarah Palin doesn't. So I wasn't surprised to see Bachman do well, and I thought before last night and think now that the only three people on that stage who might be the nominee are Romney, Pawlenty, and Bachman.
Susan Page.
Yes, I think that what Michelle Bachman did last night was go a long way to emerging as the likely Tea Party-backed candidate. You know, we know that Mitt Romney is likely to be in the finals for the nomination, and we know that there will be some candidate who's a favor of the Tea Party. She did so well last night compared to others who would like that mantle, like Rick Santorum and Herman Cain. I think she did present herself in a way that to the degree we can know what Sarah Palin is thinking, makes it a little less likely, perhaps, that she would feel the need or compelled or desire to jump in this race. I think, as I said before, Tim Pawlenty still needs to show that he's going to be in that final, when this field is narrowed down. I didn't see it last night.
Who wasn't on the stage that we might see later on, Ron Elving?
Well, of course, we've all been talking about Sarah, who might last night have been singing that old pop song, Somebody's Taking My Place. But
I like that song.
It was a good song.
Yeah.
It was a good song. And then, of course, there's John Huntsman Jr., whom most of us have been expecting to see jump in the race. He has moved to Washington. He's got a nice house here in D.C. now. He has shown every sign of having come back from China with a purpose. And we expect him to get in the race, but he has not done it officially. And there are still those who are questioning whether or not he sees a lane for himself. Then there has been a little boomlet in recent days for Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, longest serving governor in Texas history. He might remind some people of George W. Bush. That wouldn't be a positive, but he's also a different guy, and he is a strong social and fiscal conservative. I think if he were to get in the race, it would be the first time that the Republican Party has seriously considered a candidate who has expressed sympathy for the idea of secession. That would take us back to 1861 in an interesting way. But times have changed. It's a different Republican Party, and maybe Rick Perry could bring that concept into the debate.
Here's an email from Dan in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who says, now that Republicans have had their Obama bashing cathartic session, maybe the so-called candidates can start talking about something of substance, like what any of them would do to reverse the disastrous economic policies of the last Republican president, George W. Bush, and create jobs for the middle class. Mr. Pawlenty didn't even have the courage to take on Romney over his healthcare record, Steve Hayes.
Well, I think if Dan thinks that this one session got it out of their system, he's going to be sorely disappointed. I suspect that we'll have more cathartic Obama bashing sessions from the Republicans.
But are we
going
to have substantive discussions?
I think we will. And I actually think of all the criticisms you could have of the debate, it got into, given the time pressures and the formatting, there were some substantive exchanges. I mean, I think that some of the discussions of, Mitt Romney, for instance, talking about the differences between Obamacare and his care. Now, I think most conservatives in the Republican primary electorate won't buy the distinctions that he drew, but he nonetheless spent some time drawing those distinctions and talking about them in a substantive way. Tim Pawlenty was asked about his economic speech that he gave last week and asked to defend it. He did defend it, I think, by using some substance. So I guess I have a different viewpoint about the substance in the debate.
What about you, Michael?
There was some substance. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more, particularly on Pawlenty's plan, but I don't think there's going to be the kind of debate on that the country needs until and unless Pawlenty is the nominee. I looked up these numbers, and it was interesting. The United States has never had 10 years of 5% growth in its entire history, and in fact, no advanced country in the world has, except for South Korea. So that's an assumption that I think if he is the nominee, he's going to have a hard time sustaining. But I don't think that these things are going to come out very much in future Republican debates. I would agree that there's going to be less complete Obama bashing and more picking at one another. But again, I don't think there are that many huge substantive differences among them.
All right. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Let's go first to Palm Coast, Florida. Good morning, Teresa. You're on the air.
First of all, I support President Obama's reelection, but I believe that none of the Republican candidates will be the 2012 candidate. It will be Jeb Bush, and here's why. Some years back, Karl Rove said he'd be interested in helping former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, become president. I know many people think it's unlikely another Bush would run, but Jeb has a large base. His wife is Mexican descent, so he's got an edge on the Hispanic vote. The Christian right and the NRA love him, and he has a lot of wealthy, influential supporters. Now, as governor of Florida, Bush's policies left us in a shambles, but he's very ambitious and he's very arrogant. So what do your guests think of the possibility of Jeb running?
Susan Page.
Well, I would say Jeb Bush has made it pretty clear he's not going to run this time, but I agree with the caller that he's an ambitious guy with a lot of political assets, and I would not be at all surprised if he's not a candidate in 2016.
Ron.
I think you can agree with absolutely everything the caller said, but still interject. Not only has Jeb Bush kind of ruled it out as much as anyone ever can in politics, but there are also extraordinarily strong reasons for him not to make his bid now. If he ever wants to be president, I do believe he does, he has to wait until we've reached that point in history where people are saying, George W. Bush wasn't so bad.
Steve.
Yeah, I think that's true. And he has said more than the other candidates who have been sort of taking themselves out of the running in a much more forceful way that he's not interested. But I think the broader analysis that the caller makes, that we might not have seen the eventual 2012 Republican nominee on the stage, I think that may well be true. I mean, if you believe, as many conservatives do, that Mitt Romney's support is soft, that it's based mostly on name identification, that people have continuing problems with the way that he handled health care in Massachusetts, it's reasonable to assume that somebody else might get in. Paul Ryan, who has been talked about a lot, was talked about, I think he was mentioned at least 10 times on the stage last night, is now considering a bid. He hadn't been before. He'd sort of ruled himself out. He said about a week and a half ago on Neil Cavuto's show on Fox that he wanted to see how the field develops before saying, look, I'm not seriously looking at it. You've had John Thune sort of dip his toe in again recently. You've got Rick Perry, who we mentioned before, and Chris Christie, who's ruled it out before, but is giving a speech in Iowa in July. He's on CNN doing an hour-long interview tonight. He's stopped, unless I've missed it, he's stopped using the one line he used to use to take himself out of consideration, which is, I'm not ready. We haven't heard that from Chris Christie in a while.
What about Newt Gingrich? Nobody's mentioned his name so far.
Well, I think we haven't mentioned his name because we just think that he's probably not going to be the nominee unless some kind of lightning, five kinds of lightning strike. He got some attention last night. He came up with the most striking, one might say demagogic, but striking line, the Obama depression. The other thing he did that I thought was a little bit odd was that when he was asked about Paul Ryan's Medicare plan, he again kind of attacked it.
Yeah.
He certainly separated himself from it. So he said those things on Meet the Press 3 weeks ago or whenever it was. Then he spent all this time apologizing and getting pilloried for it, and his staff quit. And then at the first high-profile opportunity
Susan Page.
Yes, I agree. You know, and it's been 16 years since Newt Gingrich was in elective office. I thought you could see that last night. I thought he had a little bit of trouble getting into the mix of the debate. There were times when you kind of forgot he was up there on stage. He has that kind of professorial thing going, which is not always the most effective way, I think, for a candidate to be. So there were questions from the start about whether this is really a race in which he can emerge as a contender. Maybe he can. He's a guy who has a lot of ideas, but I didn't think he emerged as a big factor last night.
All right, to South Bend, Indiana. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning. I find it extremely hypocritical that these GOP candidates stood up there and talked about how they're pro-life, yet none of them favor some type of universal health care. I have a friend that died yesterday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For health insurance. Thank you. She worked hard. She waited until you could literally see the tumor through her skin before she sought treatment. And I just find it hypocritical that they all say they're pro-life but don't support universal health care.
It's an interesting point. What do you think, Michael?
Well, first of all, really sad and graphic story. Their opposition to Obamacare is going to be one of the central planks of all their campaigns, whoever is the nominee. I think there will be basically three things that the Republican will run on: cut taxes, shrink government, repeal the Health Care Act. That's going to be the campaign. If the economy is still bad, then that will resonate. If the economy is better, then I don't think it'll resonate so much. But that's going to be one of the central pillars of the campaign.
You know, last night, Susan, I heard Jay Rockefeller talk about Medicaid and the really horrendous problem of people who cannot afford any kind of health care. And Barry's friend certainly sounds as though she was in that position, yet I don't hear many people talking about Medicaid.
You know, Medicaid just does not have the same political punch that Medicare has, because you're talking about poor people as opposed to seniors. Seniors are very likely to vote, a big political force. Poor people less likely than more affluent Americans to vote. So even though there's a big Medicaid part of the Obama health care plan, dramatic expansion of Medicaid that some of the governors are unhappy about, it has not been part of the political discussion the way Medicare has.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Ron Elving, did you want to add to that?
Just to say that Susan is absolutely right. Medicaid being identified with the poor is not as politically potent. However, there are aspects of the Ryan plan and the cutbacks on Medicaid and capping how much the federal government will do for the states, which means that there will be less Medicaid for people on the ground. That also does apply to many seniors. Now, they may not realize that yet, but a very large proportion of all Medicaid spending goes to seniors, people who have Medicare but also wind up on Medicaid. And when that one bites, then you're going to see the seniors turn around on some of the Paul Ryan issue.
Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Listen, I wanted to make a comment based on the situation. Last night I watched a debate. There was no talk whatsoever about homelessness in this country or the amount of people on welfare. And I think that the media needs to really focus on some of these other issues, because people want to know about these things. There are a lot of people, just like your caller before, who had a friend who didn't detect her cancer until it was too late. What are we going to do about this? They seem to want to be able to give these people a safety net, but yet big corporations a free pass, and there's a big difference.
Steve Hayes.
Well, I think some of that has to do with the kind of questions that were asked. I mean, there were a couple questions on immigration, a couple questions on abortion. We didn't get questions about welfare reform. We didn't get questions about some of these other issues, homelessness, that the caller mentions. I think if you look at the way that Republicans are handling these issues more broadly, you know, some of them are eager to talk about the things that where they sense President Obama is most vulnerable. That right now is on the economy. So you saw many of them take these the questions they were asked and turn them back towards President Obama and the economy.
What about creation of jobs? Were there any new ideas, Michael?
I didn't really hear any. No, I don't think there were any. I think with regard to the caller's point, some of the issues that he seems like he's concerned about, I think those will be discussed later on. They'll be discussed in the general election campaign for sure, because you can count on Democrats to, I hope, to bring some of these things up. We'll see if they do. Also, Medicaid. Ron is absolutely right that Medicaid affects a lot more non-poor people than most people know. Democrats will probably try to bring these things out and highlight those differences between them and whoever the Republican is. But I think in a Republican context, those things aren't going to be discussed that much.
So what about jobs later on, Ron Elving?
Jobs are, in the minds of Republican candidates for president, the product of a healthy private sector. And you heard Herman Cain with his train analogy, and the engine has to be the private sector, and any jobs that are created in any other way are not really good jobs.
Ron Elving, he's Washington editor for NPR. Short break, and when we come back, more calls, your comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
The life of Harriet Beecher Stowe, how her novel Uncle Tom's Cabin helped galvanize anti-slavery sentiment in the lead-up to the Civil War. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we've had a number of people write in saying the commentator should not refer to the current health care bill as Obamacare. That feeds into the Republican argument. The bill, now law, is the Affordable Care Act, and we should remember that. Then Danny in Arlington, Texas, says it appears Republicans have no plans on how to fix the economy. They just talk about how bad President Obama is doing. The only thing they talk about is less regulation. Less regulation is what caused the banking crisis and the recession. I don't understand what they plan to do, Steve Hayes.
Well, I'm not sure that's a fair characterization. I mean, you did hear calls for tax cuts. You certainly did hear the emailer is correct in that you heard a call for less regulation. But that's the same thing you're hearing from the White House these days. The president spent a fair amount of time talking yesterday and over the past week about the need for less restrictive regulation. Now, I think at the same time that he's calling for this, he's imposing quite a bit more through the EPA and others and the 2,000-page Dodd-Frank law. But he's making the same kind of call. I think the fact of the matter is most people at this point don't know what the answer is on the economy, so you're hearing a lot of the same thing.
Michael.
There is a difference, though, between cutting payroll taxes, because payroll taxes fall most heavily on working-class people and poor people, and cutting the top marginal rates. So I think Obama and the Republicans are talking about different kinds of taxes, and I think that's a distinction that very much should be borne in mind. Again, I'd like to point to Pawlenty's economic plan, which wasn't discussed very much last night in this kind of detail. Again, it will be if he is the nominee. A study came out from the Tax Policy Center, I think, at the end of last week, which showed that his tax plan would have a cost over 10 years of $11.6 trillion. Now, to put that in perspective, the current estimates are that George Bush's tax cuts have cost over 10 years about $2.7, $2.8 trillion. So he's talking about taking from the Treasury four times as much money as the Bush tax cuts did. If he's the nominee, that should really be a front and center issue.
Susan Page, here's an email from Cedric in Charlotte, North Carolina, who says, I thought Rick Santorum was the breakout star of the debate. Very knowledgeable. Could he be the VP nod to the right if Romney wins? Bachman was solid overall. Her answer on gay marriage supporting an amendment but not trying to get state laws overturned was a consistent, mature, surprisingly nuanced, though typically conservative position. She couldn't be hypocritical considering Republican love of states' rights.
You know, I think the listener makes a good point. I thought Rick Santorum had a good night. His problem, though, is he's competing for the same group of voters that Michelle Bachman will be competing for, and he's got the additional disadvantage that he lost rather decisively his race for re-election to the Pennsylvania Senate. And some people say, well, if you can't win re-election to the Senate seat in your own state, what are your chances nationwide? He is doing an enormous amount of traveling. He's made more trips than any other contender to places like Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, and he had a good night. Now, in terms of Romney choosing him as a VP, he was the one guy who took a real shot at Romney last night, and that was on the issue of abortion. He was asked about Romney's past support of abortion rights. Of course, his flip-flop was a big issue the last time around when Romney ran for president. And Santorum said that was really a fair question, the authenticity of a candidate. Will they push an issue like that to the back burner when they're elected if they don't really believe in it? I thought that was the toughest line used against Romney in the whole evening.
All right. To Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. What really upsets me is the way the media lets the GOP candidates get away with their adoration of people serving in the military. I thought Michelle Bachman was going to drop to her knees and worship that woman who had 3 cents in the Navy. And yet, on the other side, when it comes to taking care of veterans, and this is what infuriates me about the media, they should have asked the candidates, well, how come the deplorable conditions at Walter Reed were allowed to exist under George Bush's service as president? Why were veterans being turned away with post-traumatic stress disorder from the VA because it was underfunded? Why are so many veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan war homeless? A couple months ago, USA reported nearly 70% of veterans were of the homeless were veterans. I mean, it seems like the Republicans they use veterans or they use people in the military to make it look like they're for a strong defense. But on the other side, and it was George Bush and the Republican Congress,
okay,
who were against the new GI Bill.
All right, I'm going to stop you right there. Ron Elving.
This is a longstanding critique of the Republicans and their very aggressive foreign policy stand. Certainly throughout the last decade, there was a contrast between the treatment of people who were on active service or recently returned and the treatment of some who had come back and who were in some sense or another increasingly becoming a burden upon society. Then suddenly they became people who were, you know, in that other category of people who were a drain on resources for the public sector, and that maybe in some cases were becoming an entitlement, which is, of course, something of a bad word in the Republican Party and in the conservative discussion, and therefore not quite so much revered, not quite so much lifted up in these kinds of honorific ways. There is a contradiction there, and it's been brought up before.
Steve.
No, I disagree with that. I mean, I think there have certainly been problems in the bureaucracies, whether it's at the VA, whether it's at Walter Reed. But to use that to suggest that Republicans generally don't care enough about veterans, I think it's just not true. I mean, it's hard for me to recall ever meeting a Republican office holder who's not sincere in his or her belief about taking care of veterans. Now, when these things have been brought to light, they've been taken care of, and they should have probably been more aggressively pursued at the time. But I think you've had Republicans go out of their way on many different occasions, not just by passing a bill, but by doing things on their own to help, to reach out to veterans, to help wounded warriors.
Michael.
I'd like to shift a little bit and talk about something that I think is related and return to the foreign policy discussion last night. This wasn't the Republican Party of George Bush, Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz. This was a really different Republican Party. There was Ron Paul, whom we haven't mentioned, with his isolationist streak. Aside from that, I was very struck by the conversation about Libya when all of them were basically against it, against what the administration is doing. And, you know, they had their particular points. You know, somebody made fun of France. But it's very surprising that the Republican Party, given the posture that it had on this kind of intervention over the past decade, is now apparently completely against this sort of thing. I have a feeling they're just completely against it because it's Barack Obama doing it. If it were President McCain doing it, they'd be gung-ho for it.
Did the name Muammar Gaddafi come up during the debate, or was it just what's going on in Libya? There was a lot of talk about who the rebels might be, and maybe they might be al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda-related, and that's a legitimate point. But I don't remember any of the candidates saying, well, you remember what's going on here. They're trying to throw off the tyranny of Muammar Gaddafi. I don't think that ever came up.
All right. To Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, James.
Good morning. I just wanted to add one comment that from last night's discussions there, and that was that it seems that the central policy of the Republicans, all of them, is, oh, tax cuts are the answer to everything. That's the panacea for the world. But yet, David Stockman, who was Ronald Reagan's director of the OMB, himself said that these ideological tax cutters of the Reagan administration were the significant cause for the great increase in the national debt. So why do they keep sticking to the same plan? And Bush promised, oh, tax cuts, oh, for the wealthy, oh, they create jobs. And 5 years later, we go over Niagara Falls, and we don't even have a barrel. So how do the tax cuts really pay off? That's my question.
Susan Page.
You know, this is going to be, James has identified what will be, I think, the fundamental debate going forward in this election, and that is, how do you fix this economy? And the Republican candidates have pursued a pretty consistent and very classic conservative plan, which is cut taxes, cut regulation, get the government out of the way, rely on the private sector to be the engine of growth. And James is quite right that prescription didn't work exactly as planned in the Bush administration. But that is the plan that Republicans are united behind, in contrast to a different approach that President Obama has pursued. That's going to be the referendum of this election.
Steve.
Well, I think it's not exactly accurate to draw a straight line from the Bush tax cuts to the economic collapse in 2008. But setting that aside, I think you're likely to hear a lot of discussion about tax cuts and more especially tax reform. You've had President Obama, at least rhetorically, endorse tax reform. Now, we haven't seen much in the way of his specifics, but he says he's open to tax reform, and certainly you're going to hear from Republicans about tax reform, whether it's, you know, a move to a consumption tax, whether it's a kind of two-tiered tax system that Tim Pawlenty laid out, where with the top marginal rate at 25% and the second rate at 10%, and eliminating capital gains and
but
dividends
tax. Do you think
tax.
That's going to happen before the election?
I don't think that's. I don't think we're going to see those cuts.
Right.
But I think that that will certainly be a major part of the debate, because both parties and the leaders of both parties have indicated that they want to have that debate.
Okay, I want to go back for a moment to foreign policy, Michael, because I wonder about support for bringing the troops from Afghanistan home.
The only people I heard talk about that last night at any length were Ron Paul and Mitt Romney, and Paul said, I'd be the commander-in-chief. I'm not going to sit around and listen to my generals. I'm going to tell my generals what to do, and that is going to be bring them home. A predictable Paul position. It got a fair amount of applause. I don't think that would be a majority position in the Republican Party, I don't think. Then Romney basically, to my ear, endorsed what Obama is doing. I'm going to listen to my generals, and we're going to have a phased withdrawal over the next couple of years.
And
you know, Michael, I actually thought I heard something a little different from Mitt Romney than we've heard before, where he said, we can't win independence for Afghanis. They have to win independence for themselves. And in the, I think we're hearing increasingly from the Republican candidates concern about the Afghanistan war, support for a faster pullout. We've also heard that from John Huntsman, who, of course, was not on stage last night. But this week he also talked about a feeling that the war in Afghanistan has gone on long enough, time to bring U.S. troops home. That's different from what Republicans traditionally have said.
And then Newt Gingrich said something about the National Guard and its use.
Well, Newt Gingrich, you know, was able to be himself on that stage last night for 2 hours. And while he certainly didn't dominate the event, he survived the event. And the extraordinary thing is that, you know, half the candidates in these things are they're really there to enhance their brand and their speaking fees. And they know they're never going to be on the ticket. They would absolutely go to heaven if they thought they could be the running mate. And that's usually true of about half these fields. But in Newt Gingrich's case, he had started in the upper half. Now he slid into the lower half. And the fact that he got through the whole evening being able to talk about policy and not about his entire staff quitting, I thought was a bit of a victory.
Ron Elving of NPR, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What about Herman Cain? He talked about why he'd be reluctant to appoint a Muslim to his administration. Susan, was that actually a debate question?
Well, you know, in an interview he did the other day, he said he wouldn't be comfortable appointing Muslims to his administration, and so he got called on that last night. And I thought did not have a very satisfactory answer in response, saying he meant that he didn't mean loyal Muslims. He meant Muslims who are trying to kill us. And then that we had this rather odd debate about whether you could tell in an interview whether somebody was going to be loyal to the United States or not. I thought it displayed his lack of political background. He hasn't held office before. He did run for the Senate nomination in Georgia a couple years ago. But I thought it was an answer and an issue that is going to dog him. He needs to have a more compelling response to that question that doesn't sound like he's discriminating against Muslims if he's going to be taken seriously.
Michael.
Yeah, experienced politicians have a governor in their brain, a little switch that tells them what to say and what not to say before the words actually come out of their mouths, and they know the effect of the words that they're about to speak. Experienced politicians are good at that. Herman Cain obviously is not one of those.
And finally, to Celine, Michigan. Good morning, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a two-part question. My first question is, what kind of evidence, in your opinion, did the candidates offer for their opinions, or do you feel like they were slanted more in an ideological vein? And my second question is, what kind of expectations do you think the American public has for the candidates going into this next presidential election around providing evidence, providing statistics and reports from economists? I mean, complicated, extremely complicated.
Sure is. Steve Hayes, what kind of evidence did you hear offered last night?
Well, I think, you know, as we alluded to earlier, you know, Michelle Bachmann talked about the Congressional Budget Office report to support her contentions on health care and how it relates to jobs. Interestingly, if you talk to strategists, they will tell the candidates, offer a piece of evidence here and there if you can. But if you offer too much, you're going to be down in the weeds, so much so that people will tune out and just stop paying attention to you. So I think that you'll hear some of that. You'll hear some more of that. And people, I think Republicans especially, will be glad to support evidence that cites the ideological arguments they're making. I mean, they'd be happy to talk about the 9.1 unemployment rate and the fact that the Obama administration had predicted 8% at the top. So I think you'll hear more of that. But you don't expect to hear, you know, these debates layered with lots of claims from economists.
Michael.
The Congressional Budget Office did not actually say that the Obama health care bill would kill 800,000 jobs. It said something very different. I'm not going to go into it because it's a couple minutes before 11 and it would take a lot of time. I'll just say this. The Washington Post looked at this issue a little while ago. They do this rating, which you're all familiar with, maybe some listeners are, where something is either the truth or it's one or two or three or four Pinocchios, and they gave that claim three Pinocchios. Pretty big lie.
Michael Tomasky, he is with Newsweek and The Daily Beast, Ron Elving of NPR, Steve Hayes, Weekly Standard and Fox News, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. More, quote, debates to come. I'll hope to have you all back again. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.